Welcome to episode 4 of The Short Way Home. I'm your host, Michael Chin. This podcast is released in conjunction with my new book, The Long Way Home, from Cowboy Jamboree Press. Cowboy Jamboree Press, good grit lit, home to other titles including Ben Drevlo's Ina Baby, Love Story in Reverse. Visit them online at cowboyjamboreemagazine.com. Thank you to Adam Van Winkle, the founder and general editor, for not only his collaboration on bringing this book into the world, but for the art for the book cover and this podcast artwork. For this episode, I'm focusing on the main event of In Your House Canadian Stampede, a 10-man tag team match between the Hart Foundation faction, not the tag team, Bret Hart, Owen Hart, Davey Boy Smith, Brian Pillman, and Jim Neidhart. Opposite them, Stone Cold Steve Austin, the Legion of Doom, Animal and Hawk, Goldust, and Ken Shamrock. This went down July 1997 in front of about 12,000 fans in Calgary, which, as any wrestling fans listening, and I assume if you're listening, you probably are a wrestling fan. That's the home of the Hart family, which set up a really unique dynamic for this event. So a big part of why I chose this match is not only that it's a really good one and a personal favorite of mine, but also that it's interestingly both a throwback and feels ahead of its time. Part of why I say it's a throwback is it's featuring a 10-man tag team match as its main event, and not even an elimination tag team match like is kind of the signature of the Survivor Series event, but just a 10-man tag with lots of people tagging in and out, lots of opportunities for people to break up pin attempts, and a big potential for an anticlimax when just one person happens to get pinned or submitted, and all sorts of potential for that pin or submission to happen to someone who's a relatively small part of the storyline here, kind of a background supporting character, which sort of implies there aren't that much in the way of stakes for a match like this, and there were no title shots on the line, no big stipulations, just kind of a battle for pride and kind of a grudge match between two sides. And that's the kind of thing that, the spectacle of seeing 10 wrestlers involved in the same match, I could imagine in and of itself feeling like a main event, kind of in the pre Vince McMahon era of WWE, and as a house show kind of attraction, kind of cool just to wedge that much talent, especially, some big names in there, into the same match. But even by 1997, late 90s, that feels a little passe as a concept for a main event level match. And so it was a little bit of a throwback there in that regard. It also, though, as I alluded to before, I think it feels like it's ahead of its time, in part because of this strange dynamic for the match. The Hart Foundation guys were all playing heels in the United States and kind of by default in WWE storylines. But when they went over the Canadian border and when they went over to Europe, they were mostly treated as faces. And a big part of that is kind of crowd reaction. But there was also kind of a palpable change in the way these guys sort of carried themselves and the way their opponents would carry themselves. And I think some of that could be chalked up, at least in storyline logic, to the fact that they were in front of, fans who were cheering them or, fans who were booing them in the case of the guys who were ordinarily our heroes who were kind of conducting themselves like villains. But a pretty strange dynamic there. And when I say ahead of its time, a big part of what I'm alluding to is, we would see this kind of manifest itself down the road with John Cena in particular, where, throughout his, tenure as the face of WWE, he was sort of, always playing a face character. He never did anything, overtly morally wrong or anything like that. But at the same time, he was also getting booed by a large segment of the crowd, and especially when he was up against more of an internet favorite kind of guy. So when he feuded with CM Punk, when he feuded with Daniel Bryan, when he was up against Rob Van Dam, all those kind of matches, and a similar dynamic has kind of repeated itself with Roman Reigns in that role. So it feels like there's some of the seeds of that here, where kind of smart fans or loyalists to a specific city or region siding with, you know, not necessarily the names that the storylines would tell you that they're supposed to side with. It now feels a little, again, ahead of its time to me. And part of what's fun in this dynamic is Steve Austin. He was, you know, probably already arrived at that point as the biggest face in wrestling, or at least, you know, was on a very short list, you know, top five or so, and certainly on his way to being number one, within a year's time from that. But, you know, despite how hot he was, or maybe because of how hot he was, really leans into his role of kind of playing a heel in front of this Canadian audience, taking lots of cheap shots, raising the middle fingers to the crowd. And it's a lot of fun. And, Austin has commented in a lot of interviews how he tends to actually prefer to play a heel role. And so, really kind of getting to do what he sort of enjoys best and arguably is best at. Because even as a face character, Stone Cold was usually, you know, not the guy riding in with the white hat, but rather sort of an anti-hero in and of himself. So really a pretty natural fit for this kind of switch hitter role where he's, you know, the most popular character in the States and where he's the, the chief villain when they go up into Canada. With this match, you know, in terms of, you know, how it works, I think, you know, a big part of it is just the talent involved. There are so many good workers involved in this match. And the less talented workers, guys who aren't really considered, you know, work rate guys, you know, like Animal and Hawk, for example, or Jim Neidhart, are still super over, right? I mean, the Legion of Doom is probably, the most over tag team of all time. And so they're on this, de facto heel team, and have instant credibility sort of attached to them. And Jim Neidhart, who, is probably feels like the least main eventy kind of guy, in this 10-man mix. Because they're in front of that Calgary crowd, because he, you know, used to wrestle in the Stampede Wrestling, under Brett's father, and because he's, you know, was the tag team partner of Brett and then later Owen, still is kind of a token main event guy in this setting. And I think, in a different context, you would assume that he would be the guy to take the fall if his team were going to lose. And on the other side, it would probably be, Goldust would be like the most natural pick, you know, maybe Animal or something along those lines. But regardless, I think the match kind of avoids those kind of traps and treats everybody as if they are, you know, as big a deal as their talent or as how over they are would suggest. So it sort of feels like an all-star match in that way. The match is also just, you know, really smartly constructed. In addition to just, you know, being a well-worked, you know, match with this many guys involved, a big part of the story is these worked injuries that happen over the course of the match, where first Owen Hart gets taken out of action and has to be, you know, helped to the back and appears he's not going to be able to finish the match. And then a similar thing happens to Austin, and, you know, he's taken out. So it seems like they've kind of evened the sides, which in of itself gets its own little pop. But then Austin makes a big, you know, dramatic return to the ring and, you know, the fans are booing. But then Owen returns as well. And then that gets a huge response. And I think it's really clever that the match ends with Owen Hart getting the pin on Steve Austin. The fact that Austin lost, what was about as big a deal as they could make this match. I think the only, you know, other potential route to make this feel like a real, you know, paying off as a main event match would have been, Bret Hart taking the fall for his team. I think Austin being the one, to lose when he was, you know, nearing the peak of his powers, just tells a really compelling story, makes the match feel more important. And the fact that Owen gets the pin, I think that's really smart too. I think that, you know, Brett would have been the obvious choice to get it. Owen was really over with this crowd. The response, especially when he came back from the worked injury, was really impressive. I think it was really a little more subversive, a little less expected for him to pick up the win for the team, and sort of fun. Sort of felt like an underdog moment for him to, you know, overcome the injury and then pin the biggest star from the opposite team. Just kind of a great moment. Critics will suggest, Brett himself suggested in his book that, his brother Bruce Hart, who was sitting at ringside, sort of undermined that finish of the match because he got into a brawl with some of the guys and, you know, it was all a stage thing that there was going to be some level of interaction between, You know, the team that was captained by Austin and with the Hart family at ringside. But Bruce, you know, sort of has the reputation of being a glory hound and kind of, you know, going into business for himself. And if he has an opportunity on TV, making sure that he's the center of attention. You know, and he got into this, you know, big, you know, throwing haymakers kind of moment, just as Owen was getting the pin and arguably distracted the crowd and the audience just from, you know, what was probably more important happening in the ring. But, you know, if you put that aside, still, it's such a cool moment after, you know, the Harts win. There's this big celebration with the Hart Foundation guys and with their family and with all these other fans just kind of flowing into the ring. Brett tells a really fun story in his book that there's this random kid in the ring who he doesn't recognize, and who, you know, Brett kind of goes to, and he cops to, like, yeah, I'm just a fan. I just came because this looked fun and I wanted to be a part of it. And Brett just kind of lets it go and is like, yeah, enjoy yourself here. Because that sort of, you know, what this moment was kind of stripping away the usual WWE pomp and circumstance and kind of getting closer to the roots of the business where, you know, it could be something, you know, more organic that we invite, you know, family and friends into, and fans as well. And that moment, you know, of them all celebrating in the ring, you know, I think it was a great moment at a time and in a vacuum, but especially knowing what was going to happen over the years to follow, you know, now it sort of, you know, feels like in retrospect, kind of the last great moment for this group of people. You know, Owen Hart would fall to his death live at a WWE event, you know, just a couple years down the road from this. You know, Brian Pillman would also pass away in a similar time frame. Davey Boy Smith would, you know, had already reached his peak sort of as a performer. He would defect to, you know, WCW for a while and then come back to WWE, you know, and then ultimately, you know, pass on himself. And for Brett, of course, you know, he was, you know, kind of at the top of his, you know, fame and kind of arguably in his prime as a performer in this moment. You know, it was kind of, I think, towards the tail end of his best years as an in-ring performer. But in terms of, you know, his charisma and carrying himself on the mic and, you know, especially working as a heel, it's hard to remember a time when he had better character work than in this era. But, you know, by that fall, just a, you know, less than half a year later, it'd be, you know, Survivor Series and the Montreal Screwjob, which, you know, long story short, sent him out of the company on about the ugliest terms possible and onto WCW, where he'd be, you know, sort of underutilized and misused, and then, you know, take a bad kick to the head from Goldberg that essentially ended his in-ring career. You know, and then assorted health problems after that. And, you know, and he mended fences later and came back. And, you know, I think that there's a happier ending to that story. But there's a long period that's not so happy there for him. And then, you know, and there's finally, you know, Jim Neidhart, who, you know, aside from Brett, you know, was the only living, you know, member of the team left at that point. And when you see interviews with him, didn't seem very happy in his final years, seemed very, you know, openly kind of resentful that he hadn't gotten an induction into the WWE Hall of Fame. And, you know, kind of sad to see. And then he ultimately passed away as well. And Brett ended up accepting an induction for, you know, the both of them as the Hart Foundation tag team, solo as the last man standing. And so, you know, really sad to, you know, look back at this thing, you know, less than 25 years ago, you know, it's a long time now, but it's not, you know, a long, long time. It's, you know, I'm sorry, not 25, 15. I got my math messed up. I always think the 90s are either more recent or more long ago than they were. But regardless, you know, not that long ago, but Bret Hart's the only one still alive. And even he had, you know, so much hardship after this point. This was sort of, you know, one of his last pure happy moments in a WWE ring. So in any event, for someone like myself, who's, you know, a big mark, a big fan for Bret Hart, you know, is my favorite for, you know, most of my life now. You know, it's just a really fun moment to see, you know, and I respect the heck out of Owen Hart and Brian Pillman, as well, you know, and David Boy Smith and Jim Neidhart are both, you know, nostalgic favorites too. Even if, you know, they aren't kind of as good of matches for my aesthetic and I don't necessarily go back and seek out their matches in the same way. Still guys I like a lot. And so, You know, this match, I think, you know, in some ways feels like a happy ending. If you're going to tell the story of the that generation of the Hart family and friends in wrestling, you kind of roll the credits after that match is over. So, so that's the match there. We'll go ahead and, you know, make the transition. So I'm going to be reading a piece here, you know, from the book. This is from the Autopsy and Everything After section of The Long Way Home. It's called Conversations with Ghosts. It was originally published with the Birch Gang Review. It also appeared with my chapbook from the Florida Review. Okay, Conversations with Ghosts. Those nights when the other wrestlers' breathing descended to low, rumbling snores, and the ache in my lower back wouldn't give way to dream, I talked to dead people. Cowboy Sam, most of all, a second father to me, dispensing advice on how to throw a working punch and the psychology of the business, brim of his cowboy hat over his eyes, seat reclined while I steered us down highways and dark country roads to make it to the next town. Cowboys was the second funeral I'd ever been to after Dad's, and I remember the boys all in black, but a lot of muscle shirts, a lot of cowboy boots, long hair tied back and chrome dome shining in the morning sun that peeked through the stained glass windows. Men much older than me, men who'd known cowboy longer before I did, but younger men too. He lay face up and still in an open casket. Now I lay on the floor. I drew the short straw for a bed at the Motel 6 tonight. And I look up a cowboy, standing over me, wearing full wrestling gear, the hat, the leather vest, the red spandex and knee pads and boots. Why don't you take the pills, son? I tell him I don't want to end up like him, like all the wrestlers from the 80s, addicted and ornery and buried 6 feet under. All this ruin you're running from, cowboy says, you got it all wrong. It ain't about ifs. It's about wins. It ain't about speed limit. It's about whether you enjoy the ride. Hours later, it's my father. My actual father. Always the early to rise sort. He shakes his head at me because I'm still covered in a blanket when the sun starts to show outside. You're never going to make something of yourself. He commences his jumping jacks, his morning calisthenics. He doesn't breathe hard. It didn't affect his speech. Easier when there's no breath to worry about, sure, but it was no different from now to how it was in life. You're lazy. I tell him I'm trying. I tell him I bet everything I had on this life of my choosing, that I thought he'd be proud of me, moving out of the house, trying to be the kind of man people will remember after I'm gone, someone who counted. Dad drops to the floor. Push-ups. One of the boys gags on his own spittle, coughs, moans, says shit, and rolls over to fall back asleep. Dad's on his 10th push-up, his 12th, and that common refrain, you're nothing, you're going nowhere. Except one night, easily the 100th time we've had this conversation, while he's doing pull-ups on exposed pipe 8 inches from the ceiling, the script changes. His lats bulge with power. You don't survive in stories, son. The only immortality is having someone to tell your story. He puts a finer point on it. Settle down. Have kids. I try to imagine what stories they'd tell and come up empty. I guess the point is that these stories don't exist yet. And for Christ's sake, Dad says, falling to the floor, legs falling through the floor, on the verge of disappearing entirely. Tell somebody one of my stories once in a while, will you? All right, thanks for listening. The Long Way Home is available from Cowboy Jamboree Press, distributed through Amazon. Follow me on Twitter @MikeTChin or visit MikeTChin.com for more details.